Today, we've got them in the right order. We have four bills today. We have Representative Slocum, who has promised to have her bill explained and voted on within 5 minutes.
No problem.
Representative Slocum, I am going to move. I'm going to re-refer. I'm going to move that we hear your bill and re-refer it to Commerce. I think I'm saying that correctly. 16 years of one trick dog, and now I'm making change. Representative Slocum, welcome to the committee. Mr. McGrath, welcome to the committee. Your bill is before us. Could you explain it, and then we'll move it along to Commerce, I hope.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. House File 2659 is about threading. And I have to tell you, when I was first approached, I had no clue what threading was. After it was explained to me, I'm like, oh, okay, all right, okay. What threading is and what this bill does is it defines threading. Threading is the removal of hair from eyebrows, upper lip, or other body parts through the use of cotton thread to pull hair from follicles. It has been, the Minnesota Board of Cosmetologist Examiners support the bill. It provides a licensing exemption for persons performing threading. The exemption from the salon license requirement for facilities at which only threading is happening, but no other licensed services performed. It also provides for the Board of Cosmetology rulemaking to exempt threading from cosmetology licensing. The Board of Cosmetologist Examiners support the bill. I have bipartisan support here in your committee and in the House in general. I think that's pretty much it for my part explaining the bill. Mr. McGrath is here to help me out and testify.
McGrath, did you have any comments, or are you here just to answer questions?
I am here. Mr. Chairman, I'm Lee McGrath, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chapter of the Institute for Justice, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee members have. We enthusiastically support this piece of legislation.
Are there any questions on this bill? Rams, go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick score update, too. It's 1-1 at the end of the second period. Representative, I'm pleased to see your bill. You know, we've been here for a couple of weeks, and this is the unsession. This is one of the few bills I've seen that actually addresses the unsession, so congratulations. There you go. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none. Representative Gunther.
I think I have a statement more than I did a question. I kind of researched this called cosmetology. Doesn't use chemicals, is that correct? It doesn't require the use of things that normally cosmetologists does, and what we're trying to do is not have these people have to get pass a test for cosmetology and go to school for all that time for cosmetology.
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, that's absolutely right.
Well, then I agree with the bill.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this procedure require a training module?
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it does not. Generally speaking, threading is learned from grandparents, parents, friends. The techniques.
Representative Albright.
So I'm just curious, it may be a twofold question. Has the board received complaints or concerns about this? And if there ever would be, how would the complaint be handled?
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there have been no complaints to this point. I'm going to refer to my testifier,
Mr. McGrath,
to address the what happens if there are complaints question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, Lee McGrath, the board had extensive hearings on this, and it had never and has never received a complaint. If it did receive a complaint, it could return to the committee and advocate for a licensing or registration or certification. But this is a natural, relatively painless procedure in which the practitioner just makes a cat's cradle with a piece of thread, and then after finishing with one client, just throws the thread away. There is no evidence at all that it is unsafe.
Seeing no further questions, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2559 to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Hold on a minute. Representative Fabian.
I just wanted to be clear on the bill number.
Did I have it wrong?
I think you did, sir.
2659.
Yep.
Did I say 25? So, let me do this again. The chair renews his motion to re-refer House File 2659 to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Enjoy your time in Commerce.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
The next one on our agenda is House File 2243. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you have House File 2243, correct?
That's correct.
Representative Seltzer, we are likely to hold this bill. We are planning on holding this bill over, laying this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So without further ado, if you would explain your bill. I see you have a few testifiers.
I do. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thanks, committee members, for hearing this bill today. With me, I do have Barbara Batiste, Director of the Minnesota Office of Economic Status of Women, Elaine Wyatt, Executive Director of Women Venture, and Barbara Burr, co-founder and co-owner of Step One Foods. May I invite them up to the table?
Why don't we do this? I mean, why don't you bring up a couple, or at least one of them, because you only have
one
other chair. You can bring another chair up there so you can get two of them up there. Otherwise, you start getting spread out.
Got it. Okay, Barbara. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Chair, members, I was saddened to learn that women in northern state of Minnesota still do not find the same level of support and investment opportunities that men do in the state of Minnesota, even though it's 2014. Women are more likely to be in businesses that are not high-impact businesses and create fewer job opportunities. So my bill provides a $500,000 grant to establish a Women Entrepreneurs Business Development Competitive Grant Program to facilitate creation and expansion of high-growth, high-revenue businesses by women entrepreneurs. These funds will be used for training, mentoring, and technical assistance for women startup or business expansions, and assist them in developing networks of potential investors. And it was important to me that we have a way of knowing that this program works, just with some plain facts and figures. And I was happy to find that D does a report on the outcomes from its grants, including important information such as the number of jobs created. The results from this one-time grant will also be reported, enabling the legislature to measure the success of this effort. And Mr. Chair, would you like me to take questions now, or can I go ahead with my testifiers?
Why don't we have your testifiers, and and I think it's Ms. Wyatt. Why don't you grab the other chair right next to her, and then I suspect it, Ms. Burr, I think there's a chair on the far my right, anyhow. You can grab that one and move on up there. So why don't you have Ms. Bastille, Wyatt, and Burr make their comments, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Batiste, and I'm director of the Legislative Office on the Economic Status of Women. And the Office on the Economic Status of Women is a joint House and Senate office. It's nonpartisan. Its statutory mandate is to research and report to legislators on all issues affecting the economic status of women. And the underlying purpose of this office is one we all share, and that's to protect and help women achieve their economic security for themselves and their families. House File 2243 sets up a two-year pilot project to encourage and help women to start high-growth, high-revenue businesses. I see this pilot project as a model that can be reproduced statewide. I'd like to speak about why such a pilot project is needed and how it would benefit women and our state economically. And there's good news and bad news about women-owned businesses. The good news is that women are increasingly taking control of their economic destinies by starting businesses. Nationally, the number of business startups by women is rising at rates 1.5 times as fast as the rate of total business startups. There's especially good news for women of color. African American women are starting businesses at a rate 6 times that of the general population. In fact, half of all African-American-owned businesses are owned by women. Since 1997, the number of all women-owned firms grew by 59%, which is impressive. But in the same period, the number of firms owned by women of color increased 156% to 2.7 million. And women of color now represent approximately a third of all women-owned business owners. But here's the bad news. The vast majority of women-owned businesses are smaller than the average firm, both in revenue and in the number of employees. The average revenue of women-owned businesses is 27% of male-owned businesses. And although women-owned businesses make up 29% of all businesses, they employ only about 6% of the U.S. workforce and contribute just under 4% of U.S. business revenue. In fact, the percent of the total U.S. business revenue attributable to women-owned firms hasn't increased since 1997. In Minnesota, although 1 in 4 businesses is owned by women, only a relatively small percent of women-owned businesses have any paid employees at all. You'll hear much this session about the gender pay gap for women workers. Interestingly, a similar gender pay gap exists for women business owners. In 2010, incorporated full-time self-employed women in Minnesota earned 80 cents on a comparable man's dollar. And those women entrepreneurs without incorporation earned just 60 cents on the dollar compared to their male entrepreneur peers. And why is this a problem? Well, one way is that many women-owned businesses don't generate enough revenue to support the women who own them and certainly not to support their families. And there's also a lost opportunity to our state's economy of harnessing the skill, the knowledge, and the entrepreneurial spirit of these women business owners. Why is this happening? A major reason is that women entrepreneurs tend to start businesses in industry sectors that are not high economic impact. That is, businesses that don't produce high revenue nor have many, if any, paid employees. Women-owned businesses tend to cluster in the sectors of healthcare and social assistance, educational services, administrative support, and other services. Women-owned businesses are underrepresented in the higher economic impact industry sectors of finance and insurance, transportation and warehousing, and construction. Particularly unfortunate is that women-owned businesses in the sectors of construction and transportation generate revenue equivalent to male-owned businesses in those sectors, yet women own only 7% of U.S. construction firms and only 11% of U.S. transportation and warehousing firms. In my view, the most exciting provision of this House File 2243 is its development of a recruitment program for mid-career women with an interest in starting these high economic businesses in male-dominated sectors. These may be women who have a successful career already with one of Minnesota's large corporations and high-tech firms, and women who have the skills and knowledge to peel off and start their own firms. The The pilot project would then provide intensive entrepreneurial training, mentoring, and technical assistance to these women, tailored specifically to starting one of these high economic impact businesses. And I think that the next bill that you're going to hear in this committee is the one that's aimed at encouraging women to gain job skills in higher wage, traditionally male occupations. This House File 2243 is the parallel version for women entrepreneurs. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Wyatt, I think you're next.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for supporting Women Venture. I am the executive director of Women Venture. I've been there for about 8 months. And one of the things that I want to talk with you about today is a concern that my donors have and a journey that I went on to find a program nationally that could address this particular issue. At Women Venture, we do help women start and grow small businesses, and we do a good job at that. However, we are not equipped to really generate the kind of support that women who want to do this kind of work really need. So I looked nationally, and just so you know, you're not alone. Many states are really concerned about the fact that women are not really generating these kinds of businesses, and how could they make a change? The state of Maryland really looked at this about 6 years ago, and they developed a program that really the foundation of it is actually recruiting women. Instead of having women just come as they come to Women Venture and many other economic development organizations, they actually are actively recruiting them out of academia, out of corporate America, and really actually tying them to some of the technology ideation that exists in some of the universities. So their model is really to tie it to the universities and to actually equip women with some of that intellectual capital, so to speak, if they so choose, or women who have potentially, they have businesses in this field, in high growth fields, but they really need the support to get the capital. The name of the program is Activate. It's been replicated in 4 other states, and it's had some really significant results. An independent study showed that after 5 years, that the average number of companies that was produced every year in the program was 6 companies a year. That's about 15 women that participate in the program and 6 companies. But remember, these are high growth companies. 234 jobs at a cost of about $6,000. And the average salaries that are directly tied to these businesses that were created are $50,000. And the indirect salaries tied to the jobs created are 44,000. 63% of the companies that were produced were in biotech, information technology, or professional services. So exactly the kinds of companies that actually are highly productive. And the amount of revenue that was produced in both state and local taxes was $460,000 over 4 years. So as you know, these businesses take a longer time to get going, but once they ramp up, those revenues continue to grow, the jobs grow, and then also the tax base. Thank you.
And I'm not sure, did you introduce yourself for the tape? I can't remember.
I believe I did.
Okay, good. And Ms. Burr?
Burr.
Burr.
Yes.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barb Burr, and I am the co-founder of Step One Foods. My co-founder, Elizabeth Clotus, is a local cardiologist. We are a mission-driven business, and we want to change the paradigm of healthcare. Our goal is to provide simple solutions for people who prefer food to drugs but struggle to make the necessary changes to their diet and lifestyle. I'm here today to share the challenges I have faced as an entrepreneur in Minnesota. Like any business, we need capital to raise awareness and grow our business. Without question, the biggest challenge we have faced has been access to that capital. First, traditional sources of capital are not available to startups. Banks require 3 years of profitability, and that's not realistic. We did have a loan with a small business bank for a short time, and they were simply not set up to work with us, despite the fact that we personally guaranteed and 100% collateralized that loan. SBA loans are available for asset-based purchases like equipment. Our equipment needs are minimal. Our needs are around labor. We want to hire people to grow our business. We need help with manufacturing, warehouse, sales, and marketing. These are well-paying jobs, not entry-level. But no bank accepts an employee base as collateral for a loan. We do participate in the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit, so we have made a commitment to the nearly $20 per hour annual hourly wage. Women Venture has provided loans that helped us keep the lights on while we did product development and got our foods ready for market. They also provided loans so we could buy the small amount of equipment we needed to increase our production capacity at our facility. Second, we expected to find opportunities with health and wellness initiatives within the state of Minnesota, including MinSure and other efforts to improve the health of Minnesotans and control the costs of their care. The response we've had from Minnesota agencies so far has frankly left us puzzled. To give you one example, we were introduced to a person at the Minnesota Department of Health by someone in New Mexico's Department of Health. This is literally the response we got over the phone. Oh, I don't think I can talk to a business. I thought the best way to end my statement today is to contrast our experience here with our experience working with Canada. The provincial government of Manitoba has embraced our business. We purchased several of their ingredients, and they have approached us and asked us if we would be interested in a joint venture. They intend to fund half of our clinical trial, which will take place at our own Mayo Clinic and at the University of Manitoba. They've also provided a team of food scientists who are helping us develop our second line of products for prediabetes. Manitoba sees several opportunities in our relationship. First, economic growth for their farmers whose ingredients we use in our products. Second, economic savings for their Ministry of Health as they incorporate our products into their care stream. Third, the chance to be pioneers in the area of condition-specific foods. And finally, fourth, jobs as we move into the Canadian market. We would love to see the same response and support in our own home state.
Thank you, Ms. Burr. I do love the way that we coordinate across departments. any remarks that you'd like to add before I open it up for Representative Sussing?
No, just that I'm hopeful that the committee will support our efforts to support women entrepreneurs.
Are there any questions for the testifiers? Okay, Metza, I think, had his hand up, and then Representative Albright, and then Representative Loomer and Leidiger. So go ahead, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a great bill. I have a lot of aunties, and they'd be very happy to see it pass.
Representative Loomer. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
He always asks questions.
No, I have way more ideas than him.
And I rarely do, so thanks for giving me the opportunity. And thanks for bringing this forward. Representative Seltzer, this is questions for you. You talked in your opening testimony about the statistics and such, and so I was just curious, does DEED provide a report to the legislature, like an overall report, because we've been looking at the website, I've been looking and haven't seen anything in the last couple of years. So could you just tell us?
Yes, and I was not aware as a new legislator that they do provide a report. I believe it's every other year. And so I did go online and actually looked up some information on Women Venture, which has received grants from the legislature before. And they do have reports, and it's very easy to understand, number of jobs created, that type of thing.
Representative Lummer, just so you know, Representative Gunther and I both get the reports, have for many, he's either been chair and I was ranking minority or vice versa, and I think I've gotten those reports for the last 3 or 4 years, and they're sent directly to me, but then they are posted on their website. And we've got a bill coming forth with more information requirements from the grantees and stuff. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one more question. Then does DEED track the level of pay before and after these grants, the wages for people?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not quite sure what you mean by the level of pay?
Before and after the grants are given out. Is there some tracking of the wages before and then after? The number of people trained, that type of thing. What's on there?
Representative Seltzer, if I might, and I don't mean to step in, but this is a piece that Representative Norton and I have worked on many, many times. It's not to the level that it should be just now, right now, but because again, that bill coming forth will have significant reporting, and we'll be spreading that across all of the grantees. And I don't believe they do the pre-employment wage and the post-employment wage just yet.
I don't think so.
I don't think they do right now. I'm almost positive they don't, because it is in the bill that I'm working on to bring forth in the this session requirement. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would go to any one of the business owners. But I have a number of questions with regard to, and also maybe for the author, but under the definitions, you talk about a women-owned business that is owned or controlled by a female or and organized for profit. Can you give me some idea in terms of how long the organization would have to have been in an existence before they apply for a grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this actually the grant would also be to encourage women to start businesses. So I don't. There is no. If I understand your question correctly, there is no a requirement of having been in business. Or oh, I'm sorry. The grants go to the organization. Is there a requirement for how long the organization has? I do not have that in this particular bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Albright.
To further that question, then, in terms of the screening process that would be part of awarding these grants, what type of information, such as a pro forma, P&L, balance sheet, current indebtedness, would be a party to the consideration for awarding a grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, would it be all right if I defer to the expertise of Ms. Batiste?
By all means.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the grants do not go to the businesses. The grants would go to, and there would be one grant, and it would go to a nonprofit, probably a nonprofit, that would develop this entrepreneurial training and the recruitment program. So grants don't go to a business.
I think you know.
Quick second.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is this going to one? You said one group. And you said pilot earlier,
right.
So I don't see pilot in your bill, and I would have thought that this had the opportunity to go to any number of different organizations like Women Ventures. And if you could clear that up a little bit.
Mr. Chair. Yes. Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. In any number, it could go to one organization, or DEED could award a number of grants out of this appropriation.
Representative Albright, did you have a follow-up?
I do.
I didn't steal yours, did I?
No.
Oh, good. Okay.
It appears... Okay, I have three more questions, and if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair. The next one would be in terms of under the consideration for whomever would award these grants. I'm looking at 1.22 of the bill itself. Okay. I have a question with regard to how you would go about defining the roles and responsibilities for management and daily business operations so that we truly do identify businesses that are run by women as opposed to in name only or by a figurehead on a letterhead.
Representative Seltzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deed has a lot of experience in awarding these types of grants, and if we do have anybody here from Deed, I would welcome them coming down, if that is all right.
Representative Felser, I would probably ask you not to bring Deed down because we've only got about another 10 minutes.
Okay.
But what I will tell you is that Representative Albright is kind of like his name. He's a pretty bright business guy.
Yes.
And you should probably catch up with him because he can probably give you some good ideas because he will have input into this bill as it's an omnibus bill. So if you two could work out some ways of making the definitions work a little bit better, I would appreciate it.
I would be happy to do that if you would work with me, Representative.
I just have one, maybe just an opinion, not an op-ed, but maybe just to share this. Would this, Representative Seltzer, be something that would be already the domain of Deed, but just as a partition of what they already are doing in a focused way that's already got the channel and distribution mechanism already in place with a partition specifically focused on standing up women-owned, operated, and managed organizations?
Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative D does have the infrastructure. This bill would target these funds towards those high impact businesses that women are not currently being proportionally represented in. Does that answer your question?
I look forward to talking with you offline.
Thank you, Representative.
This is Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really along the same lines of questioning, but I want to approach it a little bit differently, first of all. So I want to confirm one thing. The Minnesota Office on Economic Status of Women, Ms. Batista, who do you report to, please?
I report to the legislature.
Us.
Okay.
That's another one that's online that Bob and I have been getting reports for years.
Okay. I wanted to get that one clear. Back to the bill. What this looks like, it looks like it's a grant. It's $500,000. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to use these dollars to set up a training organization and bring people in and bring women in that way? And I'm wondering about the criteria you're going to use to bring people through, or are the dollars going to go directly to women to be sent to different training, mentoring types of organizations?
Representative
Can you
Felser.
Expand on that a little bit, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative, appropriation would go to various organizations that are already in the business of helping entrepreneurs, specifically women entrepreneurs. But this, as I mentioned earlier, the criteria would be that these women would be either entering or expanding in high impact fields, and there's a listing there under C of some examples of high impact fields that do have that are projected to generate at least $500,000 in annual revenue and create at least 10 high quality jobs. And we got the 10 high quality jobs because it just women, as you heard Ms. Batiste testify, tend to start businesses that have no or very few employees.
Representative Leiter, could I just interject a question to get your clarification? Ms. Batiste, could you, obviously Women Ventures, and we've known about Women Ventures for a long time, are there other business groups, or I'm sorry, nonprofits that focus on women's businesses specifically?
Mr. Chair, I think actually Elaine Wyatt could answer that better than I have that.
Ms. Wyatt.
Mr. Chair, there are other economic development organizations in our community that include women in their portfolio. We are the only ones in Greater Minnesota. There's also another Women's Business Development Center in Duluth, and they focus on women. and we do for the metro and south.
Thank you. So, well, President Leidiger, you had a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's I was going to talk about redundancy within the system of what we're looking at, and usually deed would run this. And this is it seems it's outside of deed. There's not a lot of liaison work that's done with this particular bill that I'm seeing. We haven't talked about it. This is kind of along the lines of your questioning, but do you work with any other organization in government?
Who are you directing that to?
I'm directing this to I'm directing it to Ms. Matiste.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I hope this is responsive, but the grant will go through deed. It will be a pass-through grant through deed. They already have a program for business development competitive grants, but they do not have one that is specifically designed to get women in these types of high economic businesses.
I'm going to try and move on to Representative Gunther.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Batista, or anyone. What is a high-growth, high-revenue business by entrepreneurs? I hope a lot of them are by women, and I thought that was exactly what Women Venture did. And I'd like to know the difference between what Women Venture does and what this program would do.
I think that's a question. Is that a question for
anybody?
Okay. Ms. Wyatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we primarily focus on women who are starting and growing small businesses, and we do not have access. For instance, we loan up to $50,000. That's our capacity. We can also do partnership loans. But what this program does, if we were going to apply for it, I would bring a national model to the proposal, whether or not it would get accepted. Because what we would want to do is also bring venture capital into play, and those connections with venture. A business like Barb's would really need more of a venture structure than a loan structure, and it's making those connections and also really a different kind of training. These are highly educated women. We tend to work with women who don't have a strong business background, and we're really training them at the base level to start and grow a business, where when I work with Barb, a lot of the work that I do is really making connections for her with the connections I have, but it would be at a greater level.
Representative Gunther.
So you're telling me that there's two different levels of women entrepreneurs. One of them that's highly educated, and one of them that probably... do you help those people in Women Venture develop business plans?
We absolutely do, yes.
Ms. Wyatt.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, do you also help those people affect financing? Because I was kind of dismayed when I heard that one of the biggest stumbling blocks women have is the getting capital. And I've talked to a lot of bankers that have lent money to a lot of people, and I never heard any of them say that we do not lend money to women, but if that's the case, I want to write a law about that. go ahead, answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do lend. We lend up to $50,000. There was a recent study done by the Small Business Administration that showed that women who had a similar business plan and the same credit score as their male counterparts were significantly less likely to get a bank loan. So those are the kinds of stories that we hear every day. Women who try to get capital from a bank, have collateral, have a strong business plan, and are not able to get capital other than through us.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, may I also jump in here? I can tell you my experience with a small business bank, and I'd like to not mention who their name is. I will tell you that, frankly, as I don't often look at the things from the perspective of being a woman business owner versus being a business owner, but the way that this bank talked to me is a way they would never have talked to a man. I left the room feeling bullied and beaten up. And I immediately called the president of the bank and scheduled a meeting to explain to him how his employee was treating clients.
That speaks volumes. Thank you. I really think that Women Venture, I have funded that program, I think, for 19 years. And I've always supported it, and I still do. I think it's a great program. I supported MEDA for years also. Mm-hmm. And they both do a wonderful job, but there's a difference in the level of business that we're going to go into. So what you're telling me is high growth, high revenue business is a business that is not like the candle shop on Dale Street. You're looking at maybe a grocery store chain or something like that. It's a high volume, certainly. Low profit, but we won't get into that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the kind of businesses that we are talking about are businesses that are typically in male-dominated fields. And if we would follow the model of the Maryland model and that's been used in other states, it would really be focused on the technology side of the business. And, really, it's certainly developed based on a community. When you think about Minnesota, we have a significant number of health-oriented companies. We have a lot of technology-based companies. And so it would be really focused in that area.
Mr. Chairman, I have a million questions, but I'm limited to one more.
We're going to vote on this in 3 minutes, so you better be quick.
Way under 3 minutes. But
yeah, well, you got two other people after you.
My brother-in-law has a gravel business in Le Sueur, Minnesota, and he sells gravel to only one person, and it's a woman-owned business. This woman is the head of the business, but she really doesn't run anything about this business. Is there any way that we can ensure that when we have a minority-owned business, like it's required by the DOT and many contractors, is there any way we can make sure that when they say this lady owns this business and we can only sell gravel through this lady, then we can make sure that that's the true case? Because it really bothers me that these things happen. Women are really put in the back seat because they're there for name only.
Would any of the four of you like to tackle that one, or would
Chair,
be careful? This is a landmine ready to go off.
There is a process to certify women-owned businesses. It is very rigorous, and it really does look at whether or not the woman is truly involved in the business, or it is a shell. And so, if you look at a business and it is certified, then you can have confidence that it is truly run by the woman.
Representative Clark, and then I'm going to make a couple comments, and we'll be laying this bill over. Representative Clark.
Yeah, I'm also very happy to see this bill. And I did have a question, the previous discussion kind of leads into it. So I was looking at one of the areas of qualified businesses is in agriculture. And I'm kind of wondering, when you were speaking, Ms. Burr, about working with the Canadian farmers, just maybe put a plug in for some Minnesota farmers, women-owned businesses. I mean, one of the things that's happening in Minnesota, there is an organization that you might want to connect with that is women farmers who are reaching the end of their they've often been widowed. They're reaching the end of their life on the farm, and they want to pass the farm on. And when you said the food for the pre-diabetics and other diabetics is coming from Canada, I thought, really good opportunity to maybe do some stuff here in Minnesota. So I just want to clue you into that and just say the one question I have about that is you have to have $20 an hour jobs, it sounds like, and that's really a challenge in agriculture. I'd love to see it happen. I think it's a challenge.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, Representative, we would love nothing better than to work through agencies here in Minnesota. I will tell you that we knocked on every door. We followed up on every introduction that we were given, and we could not make any progress. The provincial government of Manitoba approached us. They saw the opportunity that we presented, and they approached us. So that's just for your information, the contrast.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can talk.
And and we're going to lay this bill over here in a moment, but I wanted to say a few things. I was happy to hear Ms. White talk about a different model. Because as Representative Gunther spoke to this, We've been funding Women Ventures and a variety of other programs that focus on businesses primarily for minorities and women-owned businesses. And we have not, we have 6%, we have 27% of the, how many businesses are owned by women? I think I wrote it down. Oh, wrong one. That's a bit of a failure. It truly is. And we have to do better. Women in this state, I believe, are at least 50%, probably more. Yeah. I have two daughters. I'd like to see them own, well, probably not one of them own a business, but the other one might be good.
You're in trouble.
And
mentorship.
I don't think that would be the one that I'm talking about. So what's problematic for me is that I don't want to see us do the same thing over and over and over again. So I would really appreciate the link to Achieve, was it?
Activate.
And if you could share it with the committee or you share it with me, I'll share it with the rest of the committee, because we really do need to do something different. We cannot afford to have women stuck in low-paying jobs. And I, represent Clark, I am not overly thrilled with the language on page 2, line 6, which is 150% of federal poverty guideline for a family of four. That's $35,000 a year. That's something like $600 or $500 a week. That is not acceptable for women. It really isn't. And, you know, I would love to go to 200 or 250 and focus this on getting women into businesses that make a lot more money. So, I this bill is in my possession. You may see some changes to it, but I think, as a whole, this is a great start. It is not the end product to this bill, to this project. And hopefully, no matter who's in control, we all try to figure out ways to make it a much more even keel. I'm a guy, I kind of like to have it at 51-49, but, you know, I'll settle for 50%.
We'll take 51, Mr. Chair.
So with that having been said, I'm going to lay this bill over. Thank you very much. Appreciate to all the testifiers that came in today. And I hope that banker got reprimanded. I'll be kind with my wording. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 2291. Representative Morgan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
President Morgan, good to see you. Is this your first time in the committee?
I believe it is, Mr. Chair. I mean, this term.
I am going to keep this... It's too late, Jason. I'm going to keep this bill in the possession of the committee. So we're going to hear your bill. I'm going to give you 20 minutes. And then we're going to lay it over for inclusion in an omnibus bill. And I think one of your testifiers has heard my speech about doing the same thing over and over again. So tell us how you're going to do things different.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I have two folks here with me who are going to help describe the bill and answer questions about the bill. Deb Fitzpatrick from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs and Beth Peterson from the Arrowhead Economic Development Agency. Many of you know that I am a high school teacher. I'm a high school physics teacher. For 23 years, I've been teaching the best and the brightest who come through Burnsville High School, particularly in my honors physics class. These are young men and women who are ready to take on the world when I leave our class. The young women in particular often leave my class very excited about their future as possible scientists, research scientists, doctors, engineers, any number of important, challenging fields that we need good people in that are relatively high-paying jobs.
unfortunately, it is also very common that a year later or 2 years later, when they see them, they come back over the holidays around Thanksgiving or Christmas, and I talk to them about where they are in their pursuit of their goals and their dreams. And all too often, the young women who left my class, incredibly capable, talented young women in science, have come back, and something has happened. And we talk about it, and they can't put a finger on it, but they have changed their goals, and they have changed their dreams, and they often end up in more traditional women's fields. And, of course, the downside of this is that these more traditional fields tend to pay less and tend to provide less economic security for their future. So this bill is about helping to find ways to change that. And, again, with that said, I will turn it over to Deb Fitzpatrick to talk more about what the bill intends to do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I direct the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey School. I also I'm a lead on a partnership with the Women's Foundation of Minnesota called the Status of Women and Girls in Minnesota, which looks periodically at how women and girls are doing in the state of Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I would like to talk a little bit about how gender segregation in the workforce contributes to the pay gap and to continuing economic inequalities for women, and some possible solutions that are in the bill before you today. So approximately 40% of the current pay gap is attributed to women doing different work than men, and that occupational segregation and the lower value that we place on female-dominated work. Desegregation in the workforce stalled out in the 1990s and is now actually increasing among younger workers. Only 29%, for example, of men in Minnesota work in sales and service, compared to 63% of our African-American, 62% of our American Indian, and 57% of our Latina women in the state. So women remain underrepresented in many high-wage, high-demand occupations. According to Deed, the Minnesota construction industry, for example, will generate 34,000 new jobs by the end of the decade, a growth rate of nearly 40%. But in 2011 and 12, only 3% of construction program completers at Minnesota's technical colleges were women. And currently, in our state workforce, only 3% of construction laborers, 1.8% of plumbers, 3.3% of electricians, and 1.9% of carpenters are women. Now, current state and federal workforce development programs are a critically important potential intervention point. Unfortunately, our current workforce development programs, efforts nationally and here in Minnesota, are not targeted at addressing this particular problem and actually end up reinforcing occupational gender segregation and the gender wage gap. Nationally, half of women participating in workforce investment system programs receive training in clerical, office, or service occupations, compared to only 14% of men. On the flip side, over half of men get training in production, transportation, construction, extraction occupations, compared to only 6% of women. As you can see from the page, the handout that we had, you can see how that's playing out in Minnesota and our workforce development programs here in the state. So gender stereotypes about the types of work men and women can and should do, and women's lack of awareness about these jobs and knowledge about their entry paths are significant obstacles to increasing their representation in these fields. Women may also lack preparatory skills to be competitive in selection processes and selection requirements and procedures, still have disparate impact on women's acceptance into apprenticeship programs. The bill before you today was developed in consultation with Wider Opportunities for Women, a national organization working in multiple states to address gender segregation in the workforce. You will find their letter of support in your packet. In addition, we consulted with organizations in the community, such as AEOA, who will testify next, who have been working successfully on this issue, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and post-secondary institutions. Based based on suggestions from these stakeholders, our bill tackles the challenge of workforce segregation in four important ways. First of all, in Section 1 of the bill, it adds a women and non-traditional work perspective to the Governor's Workforce Development Council, an approach that has made a difference in some other states. It expands support for employers, workforce organizations, job counselors, case managers, secondary and post-secondary education institutions, and ideally partnerships of all of these to recruit, prepare, place, and retain women in non-traditional occupations and apprenticeships, especially low-income women and older women. This additional support would be provided through a new competitive deed grant program and through additional resources for the Department of Labor and Industry's efforts to retain, train, place, and retain women in skilled trade apprenticeship programs. Finally, it requires DEED to track the impact of state workforce development programs on workforce segregation and the pay gap. And we've already talked with people who are working with Representative Mahoney about making sure that these reporting pieces of this bill conform with the work you're doing, as you mentioned earlier, and in terms of looking at the impact of DEED programs. So overcoming the historical and cultural obstacles that prevent women from accessing these higher-wage, non-traditional careers is challenging and requires direct intervention. According to independent research, targeted, effective workforce programs, such as the federal Women in Entrepreneurship and Non-Traditional Occupations, which is very similar to the approach we're taking in the bill today, have been making a difference. This program, WANTO, for example, has shown that in the areas where they've made grants, they have increased the number of women in those local areas entering non-traditional fields by 25%. As wider opportunities for women states in their letter of support, by investing in a largely untapped labor pool, fostering a diverse workforce, and creating a real pipeline for women to enter these non-traditional industries, the proposed bill pursues an important and proven economic development strategy for the state. With that, it'd be my honor to turn it over to Beth Peterson, who's one of my heroes, for the great work she's been doing on the Iron Range to address this issue.
I'm glad you qualified that because I thought Representative Morgan was your hero.
We don't need another hero.
Ms. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Beth Peterson. I work for the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency. I'm the Adult Education Manager for 8 counties in northeast Minnesota. I'm also a city councilor in the city of Eveleth, known not just for hockey, but for a landmark class action suit between Eveleth Tech Knight and the women working there in that facility. And I start with that to put this kind of in context with the area that we're working in. So I really appreciate coming here and being able to speak with you about putting the gender lens to workforce development. As a poverty agency, we often see women on the public assistance rolls coming from low-skill, low-wage jobs, being put in public assistance, and going right back into a low-wage, low-skill job. So, for instance, in 2010, on the Iron Range, there were 3,443 men working in the mines, and 290 women. And that included administrative work, custodial work. That didn't mean they were in the pits with the men. And I mention that because mining is a large industry in our area and some of the, if not the, highest paying jobs in our area. So also in manufacturing, which would be welding and kind of spin-off jobs from mining, in Lake County, 10% of the 457 people working in manufacturing were women, where women make up roughly 46% of the full folks able to work. So armed with this information, in 2012, we began to pilot putting a gender lens to our workforce development projects. So we work in career pathways, which means we try and target high-wage, high-demand industries to train low-income individuals for that employment. And started recruiting women for those jobs in Lake County, and at the time, the industrial technology classes in the high school had seen in the previous 5 years less than a handful of girls entering their industrial technology classes. As we began this work, as a matter of fact, last year they had 11, from moving from 5 in 5 years to 11 in a girls' industrial technology class, and I believe you have a handout on that class. So we are looking at the full spectrum. We began with girls to encourage their mothers, and then we're working with mothers to encourage their girls in the future. So we held some focus groups, and of that, we found the two major issues keeping women from these non-traditional high-wage careers, and that's tradition and lack of awareness. And so what is tradition? It's just that women are put in a mindset that it's not something they can do. So the girls told us, my dad doesn't take me out to the garage to weld. And the women told us, we were raised to be wives. We weren't raised to weld or go into the mines. And so we did a lot of work. It took a lot of time to work with those women to help them see themselves in those workplaces, taking tours, speaking with men, working with those business owners, as well as overcoming the barriers that they have as single female-headed households, so childcare, transportation, and those issues. And to speak to the awareness piece, they didn't know that the wages that were associated with these jobs. So when we asked the girls, what would you like to be when you grow up, they said lawyer or doctor because of the wages to sustain a family. And when we said, well, if you hold a hose to hose off the mud in a mine, you make up to $100,000 a year with overtime, they were just flabbergasted. They could sit and hold a hose and make the same amount as a lawyer in our area. So there's obviously a lot more you can do in a mine than hold a hose.
I was just hoping that way. I'm going to tell you that I have another bill that's relatively important, so I'm going to try and give about 5 minutes for questions, and maybe we'll go about 5 minutes over. But if you'd like to kind of
finish up.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, no problem. So I just to finish up, the extra support in the case management and helping the women see that these roles can be filled by them or their daughters is very important. And currently we are working with a truck driver, heating, ventilation, cooling, and welding, and we have 17 women out of 33 participants interested in taking those spots.
Just so you know, you know, when you try to take your daughter out and you're not a good teacher, they kind of yell at you. I won't mention anybody who got yelled at. Do you have anything to finish up before I open it up for questions, Representative Morgan?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would go to the testifiers. I take my cue from Chair Mahoney when he expressed, you know, that we need to start thinking about how we do things differently, you know, shift the paradigm away from what maybe has or hasn't worked in the past, and in keeping with that, thinking about not where existing jobs are, but as new technologies come online, what's the vision for inclusion or support for, you know, creating those jobs for both men and women. But to that point, and this is, you know, from that point, you know, how is this initiative going to differentiate itself as it would compare or contrast to the WANTO program?
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the WANTO program, it's not significantly different. Unfortunately, the WANTO program is a $1 million a year appropriation covering the entire United States. So really only probably 6 or 7 grants are given out for that program. It's a highly successful model. There's just not adequate resources available through that program currently. And so what we're looking at is trying to replicate that on some level here in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Metza, the guy who holds the hose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you for coming down. I know the great work that you do with AEOA, and if you'll allow me a little latitude, Mr. Chair, we are in a request for a bonding bill for the work that they do.
Enough latitude.
And it's a really good one.
Representative Kiefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is more of just, you know, a statement that I hope this will be a self-correcting problem. You mentioned that girls were raised to be a certain way, and I'm hoping that through our public school system, we have all kinds of changes in the way we treat girls, what we're encouraging both boys and girls to do in school, and we're really focusing on what are the things you can do when you grow up that are going to be stable jobs, that you'll be able to raise a family and have a home. And so we talk a lot about this in all the different committees. So I'm hoping that this will self-correct over the years, and that young girls will realize there's lots more opportunities out there based on what they learn in school. But the other thing is, this could be a cultural thing that we've got to be careful not to micromanage. Parents are allowed to raise their children the way they want to, and in some cultures, it's different than what you and I might think. So we have to be careful about micromanaging that. I guess my question, Ms. Peterson, is what are the unions doing to recruit women?
Ms. Peterson.
Yes, thank you for your question. That's a very good question. I didn't come here armed with that answer. I can say that we work in our, when we develop these programs, we work to have businesses on board, which are union-organized businesses, and so they get to speak through the businesses that way. We also, for adult education within AEOA, are working with the apprenticeship programs from the union, such as pipe fitters and whatnot, to prepare women to go into those.
Thank you. Representative Kiefer, one of the stranger ways that I have been made aware of, I know a number of locals have season tickets to Roller Girls. And they have done a little bit of father-daughter stuff, you know, to try to get daughters to go in. Neither one of my two daughters wanted to get dirty, but, you know, so now they make less than, you know, never mind. But anyhow, Representative Metzer, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more in response to Representative.
Is this just another comment, or is this a question?
No, this is a response.
I already responded to her. Representative Mueller.
Wow. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Peterson, if it hadn't been for an Iron Range senator, we would have had this program about 15 years ago when Representative Gunther just walked out of the room, but I was the author, he was a co-author on, he stuck his head back in when he's mentioned. And unfortunately, the senator insisted on sending it to a women's organization who didn't understand what to do with it. So we would have had it going for 15 years up there.
Well, members, we're going to try to get to a bill that deals with military members. So I'm going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Ms. Fitzpatrick, I think witnesses and testifiers that you might want to make sure you catch up with other members and see if they've got other questions that you might have. And Ms. Peterson, thank you for coming down. And I will take Representative Metzen at his word that you do great work up there. And I do like the fact that women are working different crafts up there. So Representative Fabian, do you have an update for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sadly, Mr. Chair, yes, I do. Lakeville won in overtime, 2-1.
What?
So,
what?
I'm stunned.
Someone else is
watching. I'll be right back, Mr. Chair.
I guess that there goes one vote for this show. Representative Slavitt.
One vote down.
Yeah, it's not a great idea here. No treats and, you know, place to rub it in.
In overtime.
Representative Savick, you have House File 2469, and I think the motion would be to refer to public safety.
Thank you. Yes, that's the motion.
Okay, and for the members of the committee, we are seeing this bill because it deals with Board of Accountancy, Hospitality, and the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape, Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. So, to those particular issues, I think you might want to explain the bill a little bit, and then proceed.
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for. I'm really honored to be asked to carry this bill. Actually, this is a clone bill. It goes to seven different committees, and they asked me to bring it to two committees, and then they will put it all together at the end because they wanted to expedite getting it through committees. This bill applies to active duty members of the military or those that have recently been honorably discharged and the spouses of the active duty members. What it does, it expedites licensing if they move into this state and they are licensed in another state for some type of being electrician or whatever. It expedites that so they can go to work faster for both the military member and the spouse. It directs targeted state agencies and license boards to establish an expedited licensing procedure for otherwise qualified applications. It directs each licensing entity to establish a procedure for issuing a temporary license for qualified individuals until the application process is completed and the permanent license are issued. It will help the military. We don't have a lot of military people moving into this state, so it's in Minnesota it will probably be more for people that are just ending their services and moving back to the state. And it will help them get financially secure faster because they can get licensed in whatever their occupation is. It's a good bill, and I really support it. And I have here, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, I will. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Martin Dempsey. I'm with the Department of Defense. I work specifically for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military Community and Family Policy. I'm proud to tell you this is our number one issue coming out of the Pentagon because we realize that we have some dedicated, hardworking, and very professional service member, and we're getting ready to downsize again, as you've recently heard. Oftentimes, these service members and their spouses have licenses or have careers that are very professional, plumbers, electricians, etc., in which they can carry on into a civilian society and fill a very deep void in many communities. Unfortunately, the time it takes to get licensed in some cases, I've heard of up to 120 months, 120 days to a year in order to get some of these licenses that we feel is not a very good time frame for them to have to be without a job. I just recently at Fort Riley, Kansas, spoke with some plumbers downsizing. Fort Riley's getting ready to downsize 3,300 soldiers, and they said the same thing. They're going to stay in the plumbing field. Oftentimes, they've reached master plumber certification through the service boards. So that's where they're happy doing. They know they're competent. They like to continue that on the outside. Depending on their licensing and how long it takes, and if they can gain it, will depend if they do that or not. And the story goes on and on for every career, every exterior electrician, high wire electrician, high voltage electrician, engineers, etc. It also mirrors with the spouses, who oftentimes move up to eight times in a military career. Those spouses that move eight times change jobs eight times. They do whatever the state requires for the licensing, which again can take 120 days up to a year. And it creates a significant hardship when that licensed spouse loses the job and they're down to one paycheck. Often what results is the scenario they tell me is they send a service member on to the new duty station, the family stays behind, because that way they didn't lose a paycheck. Well, we feel that's a lose-lose for the military. Or another lose-lose for the military is the military member separates because the hardship has just become too hard to follow. We have a licensing criteria that we feel is very, very good in this bill. We like it simply because we just want the state licensing boards to look at the credentials. We don't want the state of Minnesota to do anything different than they're doing right now as far as licensing anyone in any profession. The problem we're having is getting states to look at the military training, the military education, and the military occupation, and even acknowledge that it is similar to what they're doing. Give you another scenario, there's not many states that recognize tractor trailer drivers in the military, and the military has some of the most professional tractor trailer drivers in the world hauling around hazardous munitions, hazardous chemicals, etc. They get up and down the roads just fine without problems. It's something we like to bring to the states to let the states know the issue is in their hands. They can quickly fix and give a valued workforce to the state that may currently be going unrealized. With that, Mr. Chair, I stand ready for questions.
I think Representative Ward, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm a co-author on the bill, so support the bill wholeheartedly. Just as I understand, this is to provide a temporary license when they move back into the state to get them to work, immediately. And then if there's some differences in the licensing, then they would pick up what they need within the state while they are still working within that occupation, whatever that occupation is. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's exactly correct. That's exactly what it does.
So, Mr. Chair, so then...
Representative Ward.
Thank you. So then, Mr. Curry, if there's a different standard within that state based on a different standard within the military standard, that state standard will still be met. It's just that to expedite the process for the veteran to get back to work, and so the state standard won't be diluted at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're dead on. I couldn't have said it any better.
Thank you very much.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, what you just described, Representative Ward, I don't really see that in the bill. I guess what I see in here is the person, a qualified individual, has to already have a valid license or certificate in that area in another state. Is that right? Is that a requirement?
Yes.
Mr.
Chair, Representative, that's correct. Most of these licenses are already in another state. In, with the exception of some of the military occupations don't correlate into a license.
So, Mr. Chair.
Clark.
So there would be instances then when a person did not have a license and they wouldn't be disqualified. This bill doesn't speak to that. Maybe that's something that you want to be in here, but I don't see that in here. So you're talking about, Mr. Chair, you're talking about occupations that where they've had kind of like on-the-job training and would then seem to be pretty much prepared for getting licensure but don't have it yet? Is that the idea? Or
Mr. Dempsey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in some cases that is accurate, that they could take their credentials to the licensing board and the licensing board could tell them what is required for them to gain that license.
Mr. Chairman, well, in some cases, I'm guessing they might need to have a chance to get some educational opportunities. And is there going to be resources for them to do that? I mean, I think that could be very, could work out as long as they actually have the resources to maybe go back to school or, get the extra training. How do you see that working? I don't see that in the bill either. I'm just wondering how to make it work,
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chair, Representative, the idea is just that to get the state's boards to look at the license, to let them know where they or their credentials, to let them know where they stand. For example, they need to go back to 2 years versus 4 years of education. We feel that's a win-win. If they need to get their 3 years of on-the-job requirement or current on-the-job because they maybe have been out of the job due to a PCS or a relocation, then they need to go back and get those 3 years or the continuing credits they might need for certification.
Mr. Chairman, and then in the meantime, they'd have a license they could be working without that education?
Mr. Dempsey.
Mr. Chair.
Let me answer that.
Okay.
It also provides for a temporary license if you don't quite have the qualifications and you need to go back to school or whatever you need to do. It will provide for a temporary license in that area so that you can be working while you're getting your certificate, your regular license.
And
that depends on which, you know, what type of license, you know, because it can be even the spouse, and it might be, she might be a, or he might be a beautician, and they'd have a temporary license for that. So it covers a wide range of different types of jobs.
And Representative Clark,
Mr. Chair, I think
Representative Clark, if I might, if, having read the bill, this does give the agencies that I spoke to earlier, the Cosmetology Board, the Board of Cosmetology Accountancy, and Board of Architects, leeway in developing a program that would fit to this. So I also had some concerns about the temporary license and going to work without having been looked at by the state. So I think this bill has a little bit of work to do, but this is a First Lady's initiative that I think is an important way to go forward. But it's got some leeway for the boards to make a set of rules that could address some of the concerns that you have.
Sure, I agree, and I'm just kind of offering my help to try to get through, because I think there are a lot of skills that could be built on. I just want to make sure the resources are actually there. Help with that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative, it's me. we're going to go about 5 minutes over because we have a lot of questions. I have myself, we have Command Sergeant Major Newton, Representative Purcell, Representative Uglem, and Representative Leidiger, and I'm going to cut questions off at that point. Here's my concern with this is, and it's been something that's been on the air, so to speak, or in the air for a long time. Military has a fully different set of rules and regulations and codes that they follow. It would be so much simpler, particularly in the trades, if the military would adopt the ICC codes, as most states have done now. But right now, unfortunately, if you're a plumber in the military, you use so many quick disconnects that cannot be used in a civilian installation that you can kind of get in trouble if you put it in. You use some venting systems in the military that would not be allowed in civilian housing or in civilian commercial products. So there's some things that have to be worked out, but I think this is a good start to try to figure out how we do it, and I hope Representative Savick does not mind if I give her some advice between now and I think it's public safety on the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Command Sergeant Major.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually is a clone of a bill that we heard in State Government and Veterans Affairs, and it passed unanimously. It's a good bill. And even though the focus might be on veterans who get out of the service, it's really designed to help the spouses of people as they move. They might be assigned to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and come here as an advisor at an ROTC place. I mean, we have so few military who are active duty in this state, and it primarily covers their spouses until, you know, they get to the licensing board here and are able to renew the license in the state. So I would hope that the committee supports this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Savick, for bringing this up. This bill, good bill. I want to point to line 1.16 and just have a suggestion, actually. We're talking about left service in the last 2 years, and I think it's prudent in the economic situation we've been coming out of here for the last 6-8 years that we could have a longer time frame on that and go back a little further for veterans. There's veterans that been out for a while. that are having issues, and I think they could use some help too. So I would just offer you consider a little longer time frame on that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I'll. And besides that, you answered most of my questions, but I'd just like to say this is a great bill, so thank you.
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you. I'll be brief as well, Mr. Chairman, but I've heard this now. This is my third time. I heard it in education policy as well, dealing with teacher licenses. Yeah. Heard it was in state government. It passed on both of those committees unanimously. And it does cover, really, covers all the objections, I think, appropriately in the way it is, the way it is written. It is. It talks about the expedition, expediting those permanent licenses. We're not trying to take anything away from how we set up our criteria, but it does give that temporary license right away. And it is all. It is written. It's spelled out quite well on the back page. And the one thing that we should understand is if you look at the section. 214, you know, we're talking about 14, I think it is, different licenses. So why it was probably had to be cloned and gotten on out there because you're covering a few of them that we have purview over. I think it's four or five. And it's cloned elsewhere. I support this bill. I'd like to get on this bill. And highly recommend approval. I guess that's about it.
And I have to apologize. I don't know your rank. Or is it a retired?
Commander.
Command. Retired or active?
Retired.
Retired. All right. Otherwise, I would have, done it right.
No, it's not really higher than.
We all know who does all the work in this world. Mr. Dempsey, have you got anything to add, or should I just hand it over to Representative Savick?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you for my ability to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Savick, do you have any closing comments?
No, I think this is a good bill, and I was very proud that they asked me to carry it to these two committees. And I also would like to thank Mr. Dempsey here because he came up at the last minute. I didn't know he was coming, and he saved me.
and thank you. I would like it. I have an odd thing going on here. I have two people who are going to re-refer this to public safety. Representative Newton and Representative Leidinger are referring this simultaneously on to public safety. Having made that motion, all those in favor of that motion referring House File 2469 to public safety signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And we're not going to even entertain nays. So thank you, Representative Savick and Mr. Dempsey. We stand adjourned. Oh, wait, one thing. I know Representative Newton has looked at all the minutes from the 4th.
We need to.
And, oh, no, we'll take this up next time.